I'm Roy Sharples, and welcome to the Unknown Origins podcast. Why are you listening to this podcast? Are you an industry expert looking for insights? Are you growing your career? Or are you a dear friend helping to spur your old pal on? I created the Unknown Origins podcast to have the most inspiring conversations with creative industry personalities and experts about entrepreneurship, pop culture, art, music, film, and fashion. Martin Ware is a creative polymath from forming the Human League, Heaven 17, and British Electric Foundation, to record producer who has featured on recordings totaling over 50 million sales worldwide. Martin founded Illustrious Company Limited with Vince Clark to exploit the creative and commercial possibilities of their unique 3D audioscape immersive sound technology in collaboration with fine artists, the performing arts, and corporate clients worldwide. He is a principal of Tile Yard Education and curates an extensive range of world-class art events. A visiting professor at Queen Mary College, University of London, a member of BAFTA, and a fellow of the Royal Society for the Arts, an honorary BSc at the University of London, and is the first ambassador for In Place of War. He is an international activist who helps to fight for the rights of creators and underrepresented people worldwide. Welcome, Martin Ware. What inspired and attracted you to become a musician in the first place?
Well, I've had no musical training. I'm self-taught, which is about everything that I'm any good at. And I have obviously got some kind of genetic predisposition to music. From an early age, I could always kind of pick a tune up and reproduce it pretty much. And my daughter and my son have inherited this from me. I grew up in a very poor environment, so in Sheffield, so we didn't have any instruments until I went to school. You know, everybody learns recorder and stuff. But I was always an enormous music fan, and my two sisters, who were 10 and 20 years older than me, had a huge record collection. Even though we were poor, that was our luxury. We only had four books, but we had about 200 records. So that was my main entertainment when I was growing up. I was thinking about, in the 60s, there was only one, two, or three channels, on the TV, and they didn't broadcast all day either. So yeah. There was really, when you're at home, apart from the radio, which was generally not great, it was mainly listening to Radio Luxembourg under the sheets at night, or listening to records, that my sisters bought, and which covered a lot of stuff from kind of film soundtracks to Motown to standard kind of pop records from the period. And, we had a dance set and stuff like that. So while I wasn't playing music at that period, I was obviously absorbing a lot of influences. And then when it came to, meeting people, developing and doing stuff, I became fascinated with I kind of sought out records that had got kind of futuristic sounds on them from, anything from Good Vibrations by the Beach Boys to, Telstar, stuff like that. And I kind of had an equal love of kind of weird futuristic soundtracks, like the soundtrack to The Forbidden Planet and Space Patrol and stuff like that. Anything that's kind of weird, synthesized Doctor Who, of course, stuff like that, was an enormous influence. And so when I finally got to playing something, I tried a guitar and it hurt my finger, so I didn't do that. And it was just coincided with the time when kind of cheap synthesizers were coming on, or kind of, entry level, at least, synthesizers were coming onto the market. And it coincided when I first got my wage packet, working as a computer operator. and bought a load of stuff on hire purchase, you know. Not a load of stuff. We bought a tape machine, and I bought a Korg 700S monophonic synthesizer, which was, I think, 350 quid at the time, which was a lot of money, you know, in 1975. And it kind of developed from there. I just always loved making sound. And then, of course, things like we bought a tape machine and my friends were interested, and one of my friends, Ian Marsh, who was in the Human League with me, built his own synthesizer out of a kit that he bought from Practical Electronics. And, you know, we thought that was the future. And we thought rock and roll was dead. You know, of course, that was rubbish. And we love rock and roll as well, and, you know, kind of prog rock and all the stuff that was happening in the 70s, which is, for me, personally, I thought was a golden age of music. I mean, in fact, I've just been listening to The Idiot by Iggy Pop.
Yeah.
And that sounds like the future to me now.
Yeah.
But that doesn't have so much in the way of synthesizer, but it sounded very futuristic to me. So it wasn't just about synthesizers. It was about an attitude, which I think part of it was growing up with, you know, with the space race and landing on the moon and looking forward to the year 2000 as some kind of unattainable thing. We'll all be dead by then. I'll be 43, 44 or something, you know, that kind of thing. It was a very forward-looking time. You know, in the gutter looking at the stars.
The 1970s witnessed the rapid pace of social change, an egalitarian society, diversity, broad-ranging styles and tastes. It was an era that saw the emergence of sci-fi cinema epics such as Star Wars, crime epics such as The Godfather, psychological dramas such as One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and musicals like Saturday Night Fever. Diverse and stylized music genres were also the norm, from disco, progressive rock, punk rock, new wave, funk, soul, glam rock, and heavy metal.
There's been a movement where the 80s has somehow become this all-conquering decade of partying and bacchanalia.
Yeah.
And great music. Now, there was some great music in the first half of the 80s.
Yeah.
A lot of it, actually, in the post-punk phase. But I think, on balance, I prefer the general swathe of stuff that came up in the 70s. Yeah. And I have to say, a lot of it, going back to Tony Visconti, was produced by him. And, you know, the whole New York scene, you know, krautrock, experimental kind of rock pop music.
Yeah.
And all that's kind of got a little bit washed away by the perception that punk kind of put a stop to all that, part of that. And it's a load of bollocks, really.
Yeah, I agreed.
You know, I did an interview for my podcast with Jerry Casale from Devo.
Yeah.
Devo is one of those bands that started, like, in the early 70s and went all the way through punk and out into new wave, really, and post-punk. And transcended all those major kind of earthquake moments in popular music. So, yeah. Anyway, I think a re-examination of the 70s is past its due.
Growing up in Sheffield is a creative city that fuels autonomy, individuality, and the freedom to express, manifested through its creative atmosphere and culture of industrious maker and doer ethos, where that energy and aesthetic has been channeled through the arts with a thriving music scene such as the Human League, Heaven 17, Cabaret Voltaire, and then later Pulp, Moloko, and the Arctic Monkeys. Also, its modernist architecture, most famously the Park Hill housing estate inspired by Le Corbusier's Streets in the Sky. And the spirit of that modernist and futurist sensibility, I think, was really captured sonically within some of the early recordings of your band, The Human League.
The podcast I've been doing recently, I just had a celebratory weekend of Cabaret Voltaire's influence on the whole thing. And they were like our mentors almost at that point. And listening to Chris Watson talk, and Rich, and Mal, Steve Malader, talk, they both were all singing from the same song sheet, which is basically we weren't deliberately trying to make anything that was ostensibly industrially influenced. It's just that we grew up in that, you know, with it surrounding us.
Yeah.
Those sounds were as commonplace as birds on the trees, you know.
Yeah.
Would be for some kind of hippie band in the countryside. So, I mean, you literally walk through the centre of Sheffield and you'd hear small kind of, they called them little mesters, shops, yeah. You're like small producers, finishers of cutlery or knives or whatever. And you'd hear grinding sounds all the time. You'd hear at night, I mean, particularly on a still summer's night, you could hear the drop forgers, the sound of the drop forgers, kind of booming down the valleys in Sheffield, because it's on seven hills like Rome, you know, booming down the valleys, and the kind of infrasound, it's almost like a heartbeat,
you know?
And so that obviously, as a child, has an influence on you. It's got to. I always lived near the city centre. So I just thought everywhere sounded like that. And so when people go, oh, you know, it's so creative and so unusual. Well, it's just, I believe in terms of music, you are, in terms of making music, you are what you eat. You know, you are a product of your environment. Yeah. And I say this to people. I mean, I teach music now. I teach an MA course in songwriting and production. And I say to my students all the time, you know, if you want to make music that appeals to people who live in cities, you've got to live in a city and produce it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's no, you know, it's no, we, I can, there's one salient example of this. We, with Heaven 17, when we did that, we were encouraged to use Virgin's own studios, and one of the studios was called The Manor, which was actually a manor house, which Richard Branson owned, and he converted it, and it had a accommodation, obviously, and beautiful grounds, go-kart track and a swimming pool and all the above, you know, Inglenook fireplaces, all that stuff. But, it had a fully, fully equipped state-of-the-art studio in there. And they encouraged us to use it. They said, why don't you try it? And we'll give a discount rate on it. And, you know, it's a residential studio. You can stay there. And, you know, we were there. I think we were booked in, meant to be booked in for a month, and we lasted about 4 days. Before we realized that, you know, by which time we'd realized that the music that we were creating from scratch was pastoral.
Yeah.
And was very kind of chilled, and there was no real incentive to be in the studio. We'd rather be out in the swimming pool, you know, and the go-kart track and doing whatever. So, you know, I'm very much of the opinion that you have to be in the heart of where it's happening.
Time, place, occasion is key to influencing what you manifest and what is inside and around you in everyday life, and then transcending the ordinary and routine into something that has value by putting things together that's never been done before, by connecting the past and the present to create something new. What does being a musician mean to you?
What's the cliche? If you find a job that you love, you'll never work another day again. It's that one.
Yeah.
I mean, I so often, you know, I'm being exceptionally lucky because I grew up in a time where record companies were willing to take a risk on creativity. And now the opposite is true. It's all very much about conforming, largely.
Yeah.
I mean, you see the occasional, you know, kind of world star, you know, emerge from the mass of material there is. And it's usually because they have a unique take on things. Give you an example, like Frank Ocean, for instance. He made his first album in his bedroom because he wanted to express his inner drive rather than just sign to a record company and create a something that would be controlled by them. So, and then of course, as soon as it's successful, you know, as they say, success has many friends and failure has none. All of a sudden, the record companies are swarming around them, and you know, and so on and so forth. And then the challenge is to maintain your creativity through the pressures that are put on. And that I always, again, urge my students to be as daring as possible in the first instance, because that's how you're going to get above the static and the massive people who are making stuff now. I mean, there's probably, I would say 100 times more people making music at home now than there ever was in studios in the 80s. More, maybe thousands.
The result of the democratization of technology that has made it easier, accessible, affordable, and more convenient for people to make music.
Yeah, I mean, you buy a laptop, you know, within 10 minutes you can download, well, if you buy an Apple laptop, it's got GarageBand on it.
Yeah.
You know, you can create drag and drop compositions on that in half an hour.
Yeah.
I remember my son, who now writes the most amazing stuff, using orchestral samples and stuff, full-scale epic soundtracks and stuff. But he started when he was 12 in the Scouts, and he said, oh, I want to get my creativity badge, Dad. And I said, oh, that's good. What are you going to do? He said, I'm going to do some music on GarageBand. I said, well, do you want me to kind of walk you through it? You know, do you want... He said, no, it's all right. I can do it. It's fine. And, you know, within a day, he'd come up with something that was perfectly acceptable, kind of dance pop.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, not, it wasn't exceptional, but it was as good as, you know, 70% of the stuff out there. And that was his first effort. So it's like a lot of it is much easier than it's ever been for people. It's a bit like everybody's a DJ at some point as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, because the tools are there to do it. I'm not decrying the emancipation of the means of production. It's a good thing that people have a creative outlet. But the problem is, it's very easy to make something that's acceptable. It's incredibly difficult to make something that stands out from the crowd.
True creatives are the outsiders looking in, the rebels with a cause. To be one, you must be comfortable taking a stand against oppressive forces and articulating your opinions and ideas without fear of retaliation. Creativity entails providing something new to the world, overturning the status quo by positively impacting people's lives and helping society advance. It means embracing originality and making unique connections between disparate universes, past and present, to light the way into the future. As a society, we've got mesmerized by technology and being fooled into believing that it is the answer. It is not. And as John Lasseter from Pixar once declared, that computers don't create computer animation any more than pencils create pencil animation. What creates is the artist. The key is the intelligent application of technology to unlocking human ingenuity for the greater good by pushing society forward ethically and responsibly. That has affected popular culture. When I look back, and I'm probably taking this more from a British and American perspective, is in terms of social and cultural movements that have influenced change in a way that's redefined how people play music, how people listen to music, and changed fashion in terms of how people dress, their haircuts, and what they wear, and the jargon they use. Arguably, the last time that's truly happened has probably been Acid House in the late 1980s. I mean, there's obviously been movement since then, but I believe a lot of it has been regurgitation and been quite retrogressive in its approach, rather than creating something new.
Having now travelled much more around the world in my various guises as, you know, kind of educator and stuff, and charity and stuff, the lingua franca of the world is hip-hop.
Yeah.
And so there's, as a worldwide movement for giving people a voice, however much you may or may not like hip-hop, there's absolutely no doubt that it has given disenfranchised communities around the world an infrastructure to populate it with their own meaning. Unfortunately, a lot of it has been culturally appropriated by American commercial imperatives. And so I did a project, for instance, with a charity that I'm an ambassador for called In Place of War, which gives young people opportunities in places of conflict. And I was working in a makeshift studio in a township in Zimbabwe, a place called Makakoba. And the talent was incredible. I mean, incredible. Like the Zimbabwean version of hip hop. All they wanted, we didn't say this is, we went there for a week and said, we're going to make an album in a week. You know, just whatever music you want to play. It could be, you know, traditionally inspired, or it could be whatever you want to do, anything. And, you know, I think 15 of the 16 artists that came forward were basing their whole thing on hip hop. But it gave them a voice from within their community where they had none previously, because all their lyrics were talking about their life experience.
Yeah.
And so if you're talking about movements, I would disagree with you about, if we're talking from a UK perspective, possibly, although I would also argue that even within the UK, I'm not an enormous fan of of two-step and, you know, garage and all that stuff. I mean, there's some good stuff come out of it. But and the later versions, you know, grime and whatever. Whatever the latest hip term is for a variation on it. But, you know, I mean, I live in London, so, you know, you can switch on. I never listen to it anymore, but if you switch on the FM frequencies, there's always a dozen pirate stations playing that shit 24 hours a day. And I can't, you know, there's no, it's very anonymous music, and I find that's a problem, because that's why I personally like hip hop in all its forms, because at least people feel like they are giving an expression to their inner thoughts, either through poetry, lyrics, or through the music they're creating. But going back to the Zimbabwe thing, the reason why I brought it up is there was one artist who came in. They were really good. They were a small band and they did close harmonies as well as hip hop and stuff. But they based their entire lyrical attitude on, they'd been listening to a lot of gangster rap, you know, and quite misogynistic kind of stuff. And they were just parroting what they were hearing in the US. And I stopped them halfway through the first song they played for me and said, I'm not going to put this, this is not going to go on the album. So unless you can come up with some other material that's not misogynistic, that's not saying the N-word every single line, that's not, this is not an authentic expression of where you're at. It's you trying to make, it's you trying to get rich. And they went, oh, nobody ever talked to him like that before. These kids, right? So they're like 18, 19. I said, you need to go away and look in the mirror and have a think about this. Think about how you can express yourself properly, not just through imitating. So this all comes back to you are where you, you know, you are where you come from. And that's why hip hop's, you know, a great vehicle for it, in my view.
What is your creative process? In terms of how do you dream up ideas, develop those ideas into concepts, and then bring those concepts to actualization?
It's kind of changed over the years, because obviously, you know, with the advent of really powerful digital audio workstations, the biggest revolution has been, you know, obviously virtual synthesizers for me. And, you know, being able to create everything inside the box if you wanted to. Not the least of which is because you can work on something. You can create a vibe with a rhythm or, you know, multiple instruments. Get to a certain point where you stop feeling inspired anymore. The point where you start feeling like you're going through the motions. Just stop and start another thing. or go back to a thing that you've been doing previously. And it doesn't take you forever to get back. It's instantly recallable. So this, I think, the most revolutionary thing is that you're able to work on you know, I mean, I've probably got, I don't know, 25 pieces of music in development at the moment at various stages.
Yeah.
And I do quite a lot of stuff to brief now as well, because I get asked to do quite a lot of kind of installation, you know, sound installation work because of my 3D sound system work. And that gives me just as much pleasure as writing pop songs there. More pleasure, probably.
What do you believe is the key skill to be a musician?
If you don't have an ear for music, if you can't hear a piece of music and kind of understand how it's affecting you, that's the biggest thing you need to really learn for yourself. And that comes with experience and kind of understanding how you emotionally respond to a piece of music. And that doesn't mean just pop music, you know, any music, classical, you know, I don't like the term world music, but music from around the world.
Yeah.
Does it have an emotional impact on you? Okay. Second question. It's like a flow diagram, you know. If it has an emotional impact on you, why? Then you have to start digging a bit deeper into what is it that appeals to you about this. And the problem for me in the 90s, for instance, in the UK and pretty much in the Western world in general, is a lot of the promotional activity and success got appropriated by the dance community in terms of radio. Certainly on Radio 1, for instance, it did in the UK. And around the world, you know, I like dance music, but it just became too powerful. And so the skills that are handed down of songwriting structure and things that emotionally engage with you started to become secondary to beats, in inverted commas. And so I always try to encourage people, and I, you know, it's made me very reflective, being a teacher, of course, it does that. Because you have to constantly assess what you are telling people is your opinion, and why, and you've got to justify it. So my justification is the only music I'm interested in is music that emotionally engages me. And of course, we are different people at different stages of our life. So I'd say authenticity is very important. Authentic intention of the artist. And then, of course, you know, the skill of the recording and the performance. And, you know, some people I love live and their recordings just don't match it. And some people I love the recordings and live doesn't match it, and so on and so forth. I also love a load of, and I think the new generation are a bit like this as well. The weight of instrumental music accompanying TV and film, and the standard of composition for those, because of the proliferation of content on Netflix, Amazon, whatever, Apple TV, the amount of stuff that's being commissioned. It's gigantic compared to where it used to be.
Yeah,
I mean, so it means that a lot of young people who are interested in music are actually have playlists on Spotify or YouTube or whatever that apportion equal weight to things like, you know, key musical pieces in films that they've seen, or some of them even DJ it live. I've been to several of those. And so I think we're moving into a different phase now. I think we're moving into, it's not just about pop music anymore. In fact, to a certain extent, pop music is a problem. Excuse me, sorry. But I think I'm quite optimistic that the future is more about a kind of convergent creativity around incidental music emotionally, music that's specifically designed to manipulate emotion. I.e., most stuff, if it doesn't do that job in a film or a TV show, it's not really working. So you've got to acknowledge that's part of the whole scene, or else all you're going to do, all we're going to do, and all my students are going to do, and creators all over the world are going to do, is just copy what's currently successful in the charts. And what do the charts mean anymore? You know, I couldn't tell you who's number one. I've got no interest in it. I haven't had for probably 20 years. And that's sad, you know. It means that basically it's not a zeitgeist thing anymore. It's just, you know, it's just metrics.
Yeah.
And it's a bit like, the, you know, a young creative person who wants to be successful will be just as well off posting a 15-second snippet on TikTok of their music and then monetizing the views that they get, you know. I'm not saying, look, it sounds like old bloke moaning. I'm not. I just love traditional songwriting. You know, that whole thing is very futuristic. But it's not particularly my cup of tea, but I'm not decrying it because it's not my generation, you know.
Based on the lessons learned to date, what advice would you give to an aspiring musician in terms of what are the keys to success and the pitfalls to avoid?
Resilience is the main one. If you're easily discouraged, it's not for you, because, you know, there have probably been 100 different occasions in my career where I've had knockbacks. I mean, that's over 40 years, to be honest. But and when you're on a roll, you know, when you're at your most successful period of your career, you obviously got to make hay while the sun shines. Then everything tends to be positive because everybody's wanting you to succeed because they can either gain some kudos from being associated with you or make money out of you as well. So that's not a problem when you're successful. It's when you're kind of in the in-between periods that you've got to be resilient. And sometimes people go, well, it's not for me. It's not for me. So people duck out for a while. I mean, I was just Callis, who was in the Human League. He's an old friend of mine. He used to be in the Rosillos. And, you know, he just basically stopped working with the Human League one day. Didn't announce his leaving. Nor did the band. And got married to a woman, went to live in Australia for 6 years, you know. Or particularly with female artists, a lot of them, you know, if they have children, they want, obviously, they want to devote their lives to them for a while. It happens with film stars, obviously, as well. So, you know, you've got to be resilient, and you've got to look at your, I would say, look at your career in the long term. You know, if you are just going, right, all I want is to be famous, that's a pretty sad, it's a sad ambition, frankly, because that is really ephemeral. That's like saying, I want the biggest carton of popcorn I can get. Well, when it's finished, you're going to feel sick. You know, what you really want to, I'm not going to stretch that metaphor anymore. What you really need to do is to look medium long term. And the best advice I could give is, you know, be an artist. Think of yourself as an artist, first and foremost. Do what you do from an authentic place within yourself. Express yourself authentically. Be daring. Don't try and imitate people. But acknowledge that you will inevitably... everything's pretty much been approached in some direction or other. So don't feel self-conscious about absorbing influences, but don't imitate Lock, Stock and Barrel, you know. And the worst for this is EDM, you know. It's like a lot of my students, I spend the first, the ones that I mentor, I spend, you know, the early sessions just disavowing them of the idea that if they stick to a particular formula, they're going to be massively successful, because that's not the case. Creators' ambitions have to be bigger than that if they're going to have a long career. It's that simple. You've got to look at a massive range of different influences. You know, when I was starting the Human League, my influences were ranging from disco, krautrock, prog rock, classical music. This is from somebody who didn't read or write music, by the way. Experimental computer music, you know, kind of music from around the world, weird kind of tribal rhythms from different continents, etc., etc., etc. I was be as eclectic as possible, is my advice. That will always serve you well, always, no exceptions.
Be open-minded and diversify across multiple domains. Embrace change with curiosity and always keep moving forward and evolving. Reject conventions, constantly analyze and question and challenge the status quo in the everyday life by providing an alternative and bringing it to life. People who achieve greatness do not fit a formula or follow a structure. They break the mold by following their own path and manifest their inner feelings about the world by promoting their innate point of view and using their talent to craft poetry in a world where there is only prose and grace the world with their art. What's your vision for the future of music?
These are really tough questions. That's such a, you know, my vision for the future of music. It's quite dystopian in terms of popular music. I'm a big champion of bespoke artistic expression, and so much of creativity is now kind of aiming towards efficiency almost. And you know, look, it breaks my heart, but look at the way that Radio 1.
Yeah.
Selects their playlist now. It's nothing to do with the music at all. It's purely metrics. All they do is they have a bunch of assistants who trawl the internet all the time looking for people with the most hits on their YouTube channel or whatever. And I just think it's incredibly sad. Because all that's like going, it's whether people like the public. I mean, radio is not that relevant anymore. People create their own radio stations now, I know. But it does have an impact, you know, on radio, TV, worldwide, whatever, playlists. You know, it's all aiming towards a kind of averaging out and kind of blending out of the whole thing. So ultimately, if you follow down that path, you're going to end up with compositions that all sound very similar. And it's happening. If you look at the, you know, if you can be bothered looking at the top 20 charts in the US, UK, there's not much to choose, really. There's very little that stands out, I think. So I'm a big supporter and advocate and what have you for individuality. And for organic, for this is strange coming from somebody who made their career out of electronic music, more or less. I'm a big advocate for an organic approach. And, a big influence on me is Brian Eno, who hopefully is going to be one of my guests soon on my podcast.
I'll look forward to that.
And, he had such an influence on me in terms of going, it really struck a chord with me when one of the things he used to say regularly was, you know, you've got to acknowledge the beauty of accidents.
Mm.
You know, you've got to embrace randomness. You've got to create a situation where you're creating music, whether it's electronic or in any shape or form, where you don't iron out the creases.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we live in a completely crease-free popular music world at the moment. And I loathe that. I really do. I was just, again, just going back, because I'm doing research on Tony Visconti at the moment. I was listening to Nightclubbing, you know, the Iggy Pop tune,
yeah.
Which I love. In fact, we did a cover version with the early Human League. And there's all sorts of odd, and I'm pretty sure accidental sounds that that are in the mix quite loud.
Yeah.
Whereas nowadays, if you're looking at a digital audio workstation of a multitrack on Logic or whatever, Pro Tools, the temptation is to look at something that doesn't look regular or right and just get rid of it. Or to put everything in tune. Or to put, or to, you know, to quantize all the beats. Or to make, and it's just, it takes all the fun out of it for me. So I'm listening to like nightclubbing, which is just like a drum machine thing, a slow drum machine. And there's loads of weird sounds coming in and out, and there's bits of things that sound a bit like a mistake, and that's the shit I love.
Yeah.
So maybe, I don't care if it makes me sound old-fashioned. I don't like, you know, perfection is not something for me to aspire to, I'm afraid. I've never been one of those people. I like messiness. In 2000, I started a company with Vince Clark from Eurasia called Illustris to exploit this new software that we co-designed for moving sounds around in three dimensions. So we've done like nearly 70 major projects around the world in the last 20 years. A lot of them gigantic, things like the entire Millennium Bridge, for instance, the full length of it, and a giant square in the center of Mexico City, and we've done just a huge amount of stuff. So if people want to go and have a look what we've been doing, it's interesting. It's illustriouscompany.co.uk, and it tells you about all those projects. And what that has taught me is that the beauty of sound in space is part of the future, and I've always advocated for a kind of future which is a bit like the kind of holodeck on Star Trek, you know, whatever that series is, where they have the holodeck, and the idea of replacing reality. Now, I'm not a big fan of VR. I prefer AR, at least, you know, I like the idea of augmenting the outside world rather than replacing it. But even more, what I've come to the conclusion is, it's really nice to be in either an indoor or outdoor space where, particularly with sound, you can augment what's going on. So, say, for instance, we did a big installation in an ancient forest for a thing called Forest of Imagination in Bath. And we augmented this beautiful natural environment, which is about 100 meters square. We placed speakers all over the place and created a 3D sound impression. And we changed it into a Madagascan rainforest, even though it's, you know, just on the outskirts of Bath. And in addition to that, we created some recordings of different insects from that environment, put them on a speaker on top of some kind of hard hats, and we had one insect per speaker, and the speaker was attached to the hat, and the kids could wear the hats, and it had on the front what this insect was, so the kids could participate in this magical world in sound. And the installation was called I Am an Insect, and it was massive success. Yeah. Stuff like that. You know, the idea of building imaginary worlds in people's minds using not just sound, but nowadays you can do projection mapping and even haptic and tactile kind of control things where you can move things around in space. I love all that shit. That's the future to me. So I'm less... I am still very interested in musical composition in the future. I'm just as interested in, possibly more so, in the way that all these, the worlds of immersive theatre and light, impressionistic light, immersive sound, three-dimensional sound, interaction, and people in real physical space.
Yeah.
Creating new environments and reacting to different environments. I think that's the future.
Be fearless in your expression by turning your imagination into art, by looking left when others are looking right, Seeing the unseen by creating the unexpected, with taste, style, and inherent messiness, with an inner desperation and persistence, by swimming courageously against the tide in search of the authentic and new. You have been listening to the Unknown Origins podcast. Please follow, subscribe, rate, and review us. For more information, go to unknownorigins.com. Thank you for listening. We'll be right back.